This program was recorded at InterVarsity's Following Christ Conference, held in Chicago, December 27th through 31st, 2008.
Northeastern New Jersey, a Christian school called the Mustard Seed School. I have a friend who has sent her children to the school, and I would hear good reports about it from that friend, but I never really knew anyone connected with the school. And then recently I've met Shanna, and she's going to be talking about this her exciting experiences in working with the school. So maybe, again, if you introduce yourself a little bit.
So I said a little bit last night about who I was and what I came from. As a child, I grew up in a Christian schooling environment. And so Christian schooling was just part of my life and my way of being. I went to a Christian college. When I got out of there, I had my special education degree. But my interest was not necessarily in following the special education track that was outside of the regular education track. I wanted to have this inclusion happening, this sort of fullness of seeing people fully and having them grow fully into who they are. And I think for some children with extreme needs, of course, they need different environments. But for many children, being with others is a way for them to grow into their own gifts and not be seen as limited, but to be seen as full of possibility. So after I taught special ed for 2 years, I became part of this experiment. And as I was speaking this morning with someone, I thought about being 22 and what that was like when you finish college. And you have these questions of where am I going to go and what am I going to do? And it's threatening, and it's exciting, and it's frightening, and there's all kinds of possibilities because there's very little constraint. And I thought that I had certain places I wanted to go, and I said to God I was willing to go wherever into special education. And I ended up staying in Grand Rapids, Michigan, which is where I had gone to school. And I thought for sure I was going to get sent to Detroit or somewhere deeply troubled because that's where I really wanted to be. But I ended up staying in the same place for 2 years. And then after that, I had heard about the Don Trader School, and I was excited about that possibility. But again, when I applied there, there was a closed door there. But where doors close, there are other openings. And so that's when this adventure, I guess I would call it, began with the Mustard Seed School. The image has been a wonderful image because it's about something very small growing into something very beautiful so that even the birds of the air come and nest in the branches. So I came with lots of questions. I still have lots of questions and continue to have questions. And I'm going to let you move with that. And questions are part of the way that I search out God working in my life, and they're a way that I listen. There is a Rilke says this: be patient toward all that is unsolved in your heart, and try to love the questions themselves. Live the questions now. Perhaps you will then gradually, without noticing it, live along some distant day into the answer. So I'm here to encourage you to live into the questions. And as we were talking this morning, the questions don't stop once you're through your 20s. They keep going, I think, your whole life long. So here are some of the questions that I started with. And what has drawn you to teaching? What unexpected gifts might you bring? What are your hopes and dreams as you grow into your profession? How might faith impact your work and your relationships? What role might spiritual formation have in your teaching? What is God calling you to, and how will you know? So today I'm going to share some of my own experiences in trying to answer those questions or live through those questions. And I'm going to ask you to consider your your own questions and how you might live through those too. I'll do that in a number of ways. One is to show you some photos of teachers and students from the school where I work. I also will take these questions and explore my own story with them. I have some quotes that I'd like to read you from Parker Palmer. Is anybody here familiar with Parker Palmer? So Parker Palmer has written about, there's a wonderful book I'd recommend, To Know As We Are Known, Education is a Spiritual Journey. Parker Palmer is a Christian. He's also a spiritual director. When he wrote this book, he wrote it out of the context of a Christian tradition, but it actually became popular with people in many different realms who were just looking at spirituality. And so he speaks to that, but he also speaks to the truth grounded in the Christian tradition of this book. And then I'm also going to give you time just to be silent and to think, to process. I think you hear lots of stuff from us. So I benefit from having some silence, just to sort of take in some of what I've heard. But I also want it to be a time for you to examine your own questions. These may not be your questions, but they may spur other questions, other thoughts. And sometimes the question that you came here with is not necessarily the question that's surfacing now. So I would encourage you to sort of listen to those nudges of what's coming to you now and be present to that and listen. So let's begin with a little from Parker Palmer. Most of us go into teaching not for fame or fortune, but because of a passion to connect. We feel deep kinship with some subject. We want to bring students into that relationship, to link them with the knowledge that is so life-giving to us. We want to work in community with colleagues who share our values and our vocation. Authentic spirituality wants to open us to truth, whatever truth may be, wherever truth may take us. Such a spirituality does not dictate where we must go, but trusts that any path walked with integrity will take us to a place of knowledge. Such a spirituality encourages us to welcome diversity and conflict, to tolerate ambiguity, and to embrace paradox. By this understanding, the spirituality of education is not about dictating ends. It is about examining and clarifying the inner sources of teaching and learning. The spirituality of education will ground us in the confidence that our search for truth and truth's search for us can lead us to new life beyond the death of our half-truths and your concepts. So let me just show you a few photos. We are a school where we feel that arts is communicates the soul very well, and so the visual arts are very strong here. This is a very sort of farm scene, unusual for a city school. We are a school in 1 square mile with 34,000 people. We are in Hudson County, one of the poorer counties in New Jersey. And our constituency is students from families that are Wall Street or investment bankers, students who come from the projects, and then middle class families. About a third of each, half of our students are on scholarship. Here you can see these are some self-portraits from kindergarten students, Carla and Tomash. Because we're right by New York City, and there's been some gentrification, we're having some families that are here that are European, so Tomash's portrait from Portugal. Here's Aaron. This is the music class. Music is another area of specialty for us. Students studying different cultures. This girl, actually, her mother is Japanese, and she's brought some of the things from her home to share with her class. Our music teacher is Japanese. Our staff is very diverse, and so she led this as a small class for different students. There's a Hispanic boy trying on a kimono. Every year we do a Christmas celebration of Las Posadas, which is a Hispanic celebration of Christmas. These are our junior high students, and they help lead the procession with these stars. And we walk through the city streets. It's another way to proclaim who we are and what we celebrate at Christmas time. So we walk all around the park where we play at night. It's really quite festive. And we help Mary and Joseph find a home. They stop at the library, and they have no room for them, and then we stop at Mission Burrito, and Mission Burrito has no room for them either. And we finally end up at Our Lady of Grace Church, and the doors are wide open. We take our students on lots of field trips to get them out and experiencing New York City. We're right across the river from New York City, so we have very easy access into the city. Here they're at the Federal Hall. We worship daily. We celebrate some Jewish feasts. This one, I believe, is Simchat Torah, which is celebrating the Word of God. And at the end of that, prayer shawls are put over anybody 12 and under to bless them in their study of the Word of God. And so we invite parents and teachers. You see teachers there holding over our students as we pray for them. And then we are back to a point.
So if you're not in, you're in a heavily urban center, why are children living in farms?
We have country cousins. We want our students to experience life fully, and they don't have this experience of nature very well. So in the fourth grade, we send them out to Pennsylvania for 3 days. We have a sister school out there. It's basically a Mennonite community. You'll see a few more pictures in here. And they send their eighth graders out, and their eighth graders come and they spend time in the city and they stay with us. So we've got this relationship that we developed very early on. We tried it first with our fourth graders going back and forth. That didn't work very well because our fourth graders are a little too sophisticated and savvy. Living in an urban environment is different, but we found that our fourth graders and their eighth graders made a nice connection. So let's talk a little bit about the questions, or let me explore some of these questions. What has drawn you to teaching? So for me, it's been a desire to learn. I think even as a child, I was curious. School was fascinating to me. I look back, and I think the pedagogy was not the best, but there are things that I remember getting a book and being able to read it. And I remember in third grade, hearing A Little House in the Big Woods, and I thought that story was so great because I love the woods and I love nature. And when my teacher mentioned that I could get more books like from the library, I said, well, where's the library? I did not come from a family of readers. And so she told me where the library in town was. I went home and said to my mother, you have to take me to the library. They have books there. So I went and discovered rows upon rows of books, and I was just delighted. So the thrill of reading was very important to me. Also nature. I grew up in a very small town, 12,000 people, and I had the freedom to explore fields next door, climb trees, look under rocks for frog eggs. Those were really important parts of me. And I was curious about all that. So learning in itself was delightful for me. I mentioned before I enjoyed the role of a teacher as a child. I also had a brother with learning disabilities, and my parents were immigrants, and very confused about how the educational system worked. There was no learning disability specialty at that time. My brother was sort of lost in the system and perceived as dumb, and I knew that wasn't true about him, but there was something about reading and writing that just didn't work. And so I grew up with some of the pain of that for my family and for my brother. I saw education as having a huge impact in meeting needs and forming culture, particularly with working with the poor and marginalized people. When I even think about my own family, what education did for me, it made a huge difference in my life and my capabilities and what I could do. So to me, education was a key for many people to live their lives more fully. And I wanted to help that happen for other people. I wanted to make a a difference in other people's lives. I had lots of interests. I happened to be very interested in spatial things, how things are set up and designed. And my father was a builder, and so I was constantly around buildings, and I thought at one point of going into interior design, but I thought, you know, I really think I could make a much bigger impact if I was working with children. And there's something about me and children, and I don't quite know what it is, but it happened even the other day. I went into the plenary session at night, and you know, I'm just going to sit wherever. I'm on my own, and I just go sit down. And I happened to sit right behind this toddler girl who shouted out the amen, you know. And then when I go to the elevator, there are a bunch of participants in the elevator, and there's a boy operating the elevator. And who do I talk to? I talk to the boy in the elevator, and I'm encouraging him about what a good job he's doing. So there's just been something always about me and children that make the connection. I can go in a store, and the children come up to me, and they think I'm the clerk. So I don't quite know what that is, but there's some connection, and I take that as a gift. So those things all drew me into education. What unexpected experiences or gifts might you bring? Well, for me, part of it was my family background. And I think anybody who goes into special education usually has someone with special needs in their family. It turns out that as our family grew, my older brother had schizophrenia, developed schizophrenia. And so I lived in a family where there was mental illness as well as where there was a stress of someone who wasn't learning in the way that everybody else learned. The fact that my parents were immigrants also made me much more sensitive to the needs of families, I think, that are marginalized or don't quite fit into the culture. Feel a little different from the dominant culture. And I can remember having friends come over. And my father had a very heavy accent. They were from the Netherlands. So he had a very heavy accent. And when he would speak to my friends, they wouldn't understand what he was saying. And I would see that they couldn't understand, so they didn't know how to respond. So I very early on learned how to do this paraphrasing sort of thing, where he would say something, and then to help preserve his dignity, rather than repeating exactly what he said, I found a different way to sort of echo what he was saying. That way my friends knew what he was saying and they could respond back to him. Well, apparently that has developed within me a skill that I use often when I'm meeting with people. And I've had people say to me, we really missed having you in the group. And I realized that part of the gift the skill that I've developed is this ability to mediate within a group, to help people understand each other. Because I'm very sensitive when people aren't understanding. And that actually is a gift. And I'm thinking that there are gifts that perhaps you have in that way too that you may not realize now. And I didn't, at 22, I didn't see that as a gift at all. I saw that as a, you know, as a coping mechanism. But I think there are things like that that may be gifts that you can use. There are cultural gifts. I came from a Dutch subculture, which was very sensible, very stable, very steadfast. These things were not exciting to me. And when I moved out east to help start the school, this is what I heard. Oh, you're so sensible, you're so stable. I just thought it's so boring. But what I discovered was that there was a lot of anxiety around the people whom I was working with. And when you're starting up something new, they're looking for some security in something that's new. And there was a way in which I had that for some people. And so that resonated with people and was actually very helpful. So sometimes the things that your culture gives you that you really devalue may be a great gift that you have to bring someplace to. And then there's your personal inclination. So I love to explore. That's something that I keep doing, keep trying new things. I love music. Music has been very beneficial in the starting of the school and the work that I do. I'm pretty good at programming and organizing things. I like arranging things. That's very helpful when you're starting to build up a new school, to be able to organize and set up programs. So those are all aptitudes that I have that help me. And the environment is important to me. How happens. And we will talk about environment being the third teacher in our school. So hopefully you'll see some of that as you look at the pictures. A lot of the work that's in the school that's displayed is the children's artwork. It's not a lot of children's. It's mainly the children to show that the space belongs to the children, that children can create beautiful things, and that they participate in developing them. There also are turning points. There's experiences in your life that are perhaps turning points for you. For me, one of them was when I was teaching special ed and I had Walter approach me with a Bible and want to read it, and I felt very conflicted because I didn't know. Can I really read this Bible with him? Can I not? I don't want to have to think about whether I can do this or I can't do this. I want to be able to feel fully free to do that, and that's part of the impetus that moved me into going into Christian education as opposed to just public education. For others, that may have been a different kind of turning point. But for me, that made a difference for me. There are also our limitations that come. And there's brokenness that comes into everyone's life at some point. My parents helped fund my college education. They thought being a teacher was great. The other thing I had considered was being a director of religious education in a church. My father was very conservative and had some difficulties with that, and I had a struggle with, well, was I really going to press that or not? And then I decided that I would not, that was not something that I needed to do, that there were other ways that I could live out my faith without having to be necessarily within a church. There's brokenness. I'm a single parent. I was divorced, and I have two children. And so there are time constraints, family constraints that come with that. There's not quite the same level of freedom to explore as if you're single, you know, or if you have a spouse who's very supportive of you and alongside of you. So those things are not necessarily detriments. They actually can be things that are very healing. And they can be gifts. For example, I went on a trip to South Africa, a missions trip, and I was encouraged to share my brokenness. So I thought, okay, do I really want to talk about divorce? And I was speaking to a bunch of children. And I thought, okay, I need to talk about the divorce. So I found a simple way to talk about it, to just mention it as part of my life. And yet the focus was on being thankful and grateful. And so I talked about the things I could be grateful for while being honest and authentic. But I also talked about the brokenness. And at the very end, I had a Sunday school teacher come up to me and said, I am so glad that you talked about your divorce. He said, because there's a little boy in our Sunday school, and his family is divorced, and he never talks about his dad. And when we all had to put something we were thankful for up on the tree, he wrote his dad's name and put it up there. And he said, and I don't think that ever would have happened. So some of the broken areas in your life, I want to encourage you, can be a gift to someone else. It can bring greater understanding. But it means being open, right? And sharing. So I want you to think a bit about those questions in your life. What are the experiences or gifts that you bring? And what draws you into education? I'm just going to give you a few moments.
Can you say them again once?
Yes. What has drawn you to teaching? And what unexpected experiences and gifts might you bring? I want to read to you a little bit about Noah from Parker Palmer. I've come to see that knowledge contains its own morality, that it begins not in a neutrality, but in a place of passion within the human soul. History suggests two primary sources for our knowledge. One is curiosity, the other is control. The one corresponds to pure speculative knowledge, to knowledge as an end in itself. The other corresponds to applied science, to knowledge as a means to practical ends. But another kind of knowledge is available to us, one that begins in a different passion and is drawn toward other ends. This knowledge can contain as much sound fact and theory as the knowledge we now possess. But because it springs from a truer passion, it works toward truer ends. This is a knowledge that originates not in curiosity or control, but in compassion or love, a source celebrated not in our intellectual tradition, but in our spiritual heritage. The goal of knowledge arising from love is the reunification and reconstruction of broken selves and worlds. A knowledge born of compassion aims not at exploiting or manipulating creation, but at reconciling the world to itself. The mind motivated by compassion reaches out to know as the heart reaches out to love. Here, the act of knowing is an act of love. The act of entering and embracing the reality of the other, of allowing the other to enter and embrace our own. In such knowing, we know and are known as members of one community, and our knowing becomes a way of reweaving the community's bonds. These are students on a hike, try to build a connection to nature. We have 34,000 people living in 1 square mile, so you can imagine there's not a lot of nature. So we take a bus trip up the river and walk along. This is our Jesse tree. It's a way that we celebrate Advent. We tell stories. You can see the apple from Adam and Eve, Noah's Ark, the kings. Joseph's coat of many colors. We tell these stories of faith, of people waiting for a savior. And then we get to this celebration of Las Posadas. We do many service projects. This one is collecting stuffed animals for children infected with HIV. There you see Mary and Joseph in our worship time. At this time, we gather all the students from kindergarten through eighth grade in one room to worship. We don't typically do that. We do for certain celebrations in the year, but during this time, we do. And there they are. It's really quite an honor to be Mary and Joseph. They're carrying the stars at Las Posadas. Young children dress up as Bethlehem townspeople or shepherds, angels we got. There's the Holy Family and the three kings. The junior high school needs to all the leadership. I think they were told to smile. this is a certificate of participation for a geography bee. We have children from many backgrounds and cultures. We celebrate China's New Year, and so you'll see some pictures here. The third grade class especially does. The teacher here has been to China on a six-week project where she was teaching English. And here they're enjoying a festive lunch. And we have some parents who come in and do crafts with them from Chinese New Year. We had a poetry day, and students from all over the school came into our community room to share poetry with each other. Third grade poets. They wrote poetry. Did poetry off of paintings or paintings off of poetry. We have a lot of English language learners in our school, and so we work a lot on how to develop language within them. We try to do cross-grade activities to help develop a sense of community within the school. So here are my next two questions. What are your hopes and dreams as you grow into your profession? And how might faith impact your work and your religion? What are your hopes and dreams as you grow into your profession? Well, for me, they were to work in a place to mainstream special education kids effectively. So the school is not a special ed school. The school is an urban school. We have children from all different backgrounds, but we do have children with special needs. And as well as, you know, when we feel like we can accommodate them within our system, we do. We had two girls who were adopted and had polio and were in wheelchairs. And we brought them into our school, and we weren't quite sure whether we could actually meet their needs, but they became such a blessing to us. Because their handicap became just part of the normal way of life for many of the children. They learned how to, her classmates learned how to hold books for her. Her classmates learned how to help her go up steps. They took turns. It was not a burden for them. And they saw Margaret and Maria, her sister, as very full-fledged people. And I think that was a true gift for them. Margaret, by the way, went to China and was a para athlete in one of these competitions where she had one of those jogging sort of, it looks like a jogging stroller is what she's in, but it's wheelchair racing in a way. And so she was one of the contestants because she's very good at doing that. And she and her sister have gone skiing. I mean, her mother has had them do all different kinds of physical activities just to show them that a disability was not an impediment. And I think that was a great gift for our children, too. So to work in that kind of a place where those children would be welcome is important. To work with children in a way that acknowledges the giftedness of each as well as their limitations. So we have children who have difficulty with language or who don't have the language. That they need to express truly. There's a lot of thing and stuff and gotta do that kind of language going on. And one of the ways that we find they truly express themselves best is through the arts. So when they're using their hands to make something, design something, they can often show in a much better way what their true understanding is. And so while you have a child who may have difficulty with paper and pencil tasks or with reading, there often is, when you go into, we have a room called the shared space, which is a room where they do arts activities. And children, kindergarten to fifth grade, go into that space every day. And they design work that's connected to their studies. And when they come out of that space, you'll find that some of these children who struggle in the reading and writing are some of the leaders in that other area. So it's a place for them to excel. It's a place for them to be renewed and refreshed. Have to go back to that difficult task, reading and writing. And it levels the playing ground because some of our readers and writers who are very strong don't have that same kind of skill when we get into the arts. And so they're, a lot of times they're not top of the line there, and that's a good thing for them too. So to work, to have within the school a context for children to excel in something that they're good at and be rewarded with that, renewed by that, as well as to have children who have limitations and recognize them. There are some children who are very good leaders, but they're not good followers. And so one time for one child, I gave him a goal. I said, look, you need to learn how to be a follower. You're very good at leading, but my goal for you is to be a follower. Because he was always taking charge, you know, for taking charge, and people were letting him do that. And I said, you need to leave space for some other people. So the only way that was going to happen is if I gave him the goal of being a follower. And so he was very intentional about that. He needed to be reminded of when he was reminded, what's your goal? Then he knew, I have to take a back seat here. And I have, because at some point in life, we all have to learn to take the lead and to let somebody else take the lead. To work with children and colleagues in collaboration, I'm blessed to work with people from all different backgrounds. I help lead the worship music in the school. And so our music teacher, one music teacher who leads it is Japanese. The other one is Cuban. And then you have me. And we all come from different musical backgrounds. So there's this diversity of music that comes into the school because of our backgrounds. So that's a beautiful thing to me. Same with the religious backgrounds. It's an interdenominational school, so there are Catholics who teach in the school, as well as Presbyterians and Episcopalians and Reformed people and Lutherans. There's just a wealth of diversity of where people come from, but we hold together on the unity of Christ. And they're, you know, the Catholics know if they want to, you know, find a Bible verse, they got to go find a Protestant. And the Protestant knows that if they really want to, you know, get into some sort of more mystical, mystery experience, you got to go talk to a Catholic. So it's a great thing. It brings out all the richness of our traditions. to work in a holistic manner, recognizing the spiritual aspects of life, that children are created in the image of God, that each person is a child of God. A kindergarten teacher of ours said that she taught this term very early on to parents when they were coming to the back to school night, that everyone is a child of God. And that she used that when she worked with the children. So when she would get irritated with someone, she would say the child's name, and you can imagine the barrage that would happen next. But then under her breath, she would say, child of God. And when she said that, it tempered what she was going to say next, because she recognized the true identity. And it's about being able to see a true identity within each person as a child of God. I wanted to be in a place where I could be personal about my faith, and felt free to do that. And I wanted to empower the poor and the marginalized. So I had gone and visited lots of different places, but for me there was something about urban education that seemed to fit with who I was and what I wanted to do. So I really felt called to be in an urban area and work with kids in an urban environment. How might faith impact your work and your relationships? Well, I think first of all, one has to have eyes and ears to see God at work. When the prophets keep saying, you know, oh, you who have, you know, do you have ears to hear, eyes to see? I think we need to pray for that daily, to have ears to hear and eyes to see God at work. It helps us refocus as we go into our days. And to trust that God is there, but a lot of times we're just blinded or we're just not listening to what he has to see. When new teachers come to our school, the first thing we talk to them about is learning to know children. Know children as created in the image of God, as a child of God. And then to know children, it means that we have to see them and hear them and listen to them. So your first weeks are about setting up procedures, certainly, but it's also about observing children, seeing them. It's about listening in to them. We have listening conferences at our school. It's the first conference that happens, so that when you meet a family, the first time you meet them, it's not about telling a problem about their child, but the first conference you have is, tell me about your child. Tell me a story. Help me to know this person. You know this child better than I do. What are your hopes and your dreams for this child? And when you do that, you develop a relationship right away with this family, and you come to see this child as parents see the child. It's very, very helpful, and our teachers have found it to be tremendously helpful in getting to know children better and getting to understand that how the child's place in the family. To embrace unexpected opportunities that arise, I think that's a thing. There are things that happen in your day that you did not expect to happen, and how you're going to handle that, or how you're going to see that as an opportunity for God to work through that is a way of seeing that as an opportunity for God to be present, not as a problem to be encountered, but a way for God to be working within you. So to embrace those opportunities, your faith works when you speak up for injustice, or to protect the dignity of everyone. I remember one time I was walking the kindergarten class very early on into the park, and this was one of those moments where you're just sort of going, what is it that I do? One of those unexpected opportunities. There was a man who was holding a woman by the arms and shaking her, and it was sort of a violent encounter. And I thought, here I'm bringing all these young children into the park, we're going to play, and there is this violent encounter happening. And I thought, I can't let this go on as I walk by. I just had this image of the Samaritan youth, and then the Levite going on by. And so, again, it probably, at that point, it didn't seem very, you're just sort of in this autopilot. I just felt like I had to speak to the man. So I spoke to the man, and I said, you should not be doing this here. And he looked at me like he was startled. And he said, I know you. And he ran away. And there was somebody else who came out to the woman, and I just continued on my way. Now, who knows how that would have turned out. But there's a way that sometimes there's an opportunity that arises and that you feel compelled to speak. And this woman obviously could not defend herself. And so my sense was that my voice perhaps might make a difference, but I could not pass by in front of all these children following me and not say anything. I felt like that was a lesson I had to teach them that day, so they needed to speak up. When I talk about being personal in your faith, for me at the school, I grew up in a Christian school, but I would say my teachers were not personal about their faith. I didn't see how their faith really made a difference. I knew that Christianity was important, but I had no sense of it as being part of their personal life. So in our school, we do have a worship talk that's daily, and we encourage teachers to share their personal life with children, their personal life as a child, what impact stories from their own family life, and how that reflects on their faith. So that faith isn't just seen as something that's out there, but it's something embodied within us. At the end of the day, we have reflection meetings where for the last 50 minutes or so, children will sing or will talk, and then they'll have a time of prayer. And if you sat in the third grade, you'll see the hands shooting up right away about things they want prayer for, concerns that they have that they readily bring up, and the teacher will bring up some internal concerns too for a family. Those things, I think, help build the sense of community, the Christian community, among the children and the teachers. To serve and to involve children in serving others. So we serve the children, but we also invite them to serve other people. We do money collections, we do collections of Band-Aids, you saw the stuffed animal collection. We collect baby food for the local pantry. We have the children bring it to the local pantry. We want to have service be a way of life, something that's very real and tangible. Your faith also will require you to sacrifice. We follow the model of Jesus, and it is a model of sacrifice. But I would say it's not a model of sacrifice in the sense of being a martyr. It is not without joy. And if you get to a place where you feel like the work you're doing is good work, but there's resentment, or it just seems very burdensome, and there's no joy in the work, then you need to ask that question again about where you belong and what you need to do. There's sacrifice, but there's not sacrifice without a sense of joy. Faith, I think a lot of times I hear people talking about the conversion experience in the sense of wanting children or others to claim Jesus as their personal Lord and Savior. And I think that is all very worthy. But I think faith also encompasses all the things that go around that. Sometimes faith is plowing up the ground to make the soil fertile for the seed to be planted. And sometimes that may be what you're called to do. And sometimes it's about nurturing that little one, that precious one. Sometimes it's about building that person or that community up so that there can be true trust and sharing. It's about bringing healing into a broken world. And that brokenness can happen in any community, a Christian community as well as in a public community. So I just think that now that as a teacher you're sowing seeds, you're preparing the soil, you're nurturing the growth, there's lots of ways that we live out our faith. To develop a sense of community among your colleagues and students, I think is very important, and I think Christians can do that. To integrate faith into language, stories. For me in a Christian school, it's also in the prayer and the worship. There can be prayer that happens, though, outside of vocal prayer. We pray in lots of different ways in our school. And I think faith means failing well. I talk about that sometimes. I hope that our students learn how to fail well, because if you're too afraid of failing, you won't take any risks. And the kindergarten teacher likes to say, somebody goes, "I didn't make a mistake." And she goes, "Okay." She said, but you know, I have to say, when people do make mistakes, those are the people who learn really well. And you learn from your mistakes. If you're too afraid of making a mistake, then you're not, possibly not growing as much as you could. So to try and engender within children, there is a way to fail well. And there's times to succeed, but there's times when we all fail too. And then the last thing I would say is to listen. And I get more and more convinced of this the older I get, is that listening is perhaps one of the most powerful things we can do as teachers, is to listen to the other. To listen to them, to be. Sometimes it's just creating a space for them to be who they are, a space that's welcoming, that's encouraging, that's important. Your hopes and dreams as you grow into your profession, and how might faith impact your work and your relationships? It is the Christian tradition. The central claim is not that God takes us out of ourselves and our world into ethereal realms, but that God broke in to reveal us and our world as we are. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, full of grace and truth. In this movement, spirit and matter were fused and made whole. The distinction we make between sacred and secular was overcome. Self and world were permeated with transcendent possibility, the possibility of love. In Christian tradition, truth is not a concept that works, but an incarnation that lives. The word our knowledge seeks is not a verbal construct, but a reality in history and flesh. Christian tradition understands truth to be embodied in personal terms, the term of the one who said, "I am the way and the truth and the life." Where conventional education deals with abstract and impersonal facts and theories, an education shaped by Christian spirituality draws us toward incarnate and personal truth. In this education, we come to know the world not simply as an objectified system of empirical objects and logical connection with each other, but as an organic body of personal relations and responses, a living and evolving community of creativity and compassion. Education of this sort means more than teaching the facts and learning the reasons so we can manipulate life towards our end. It means being drawn into personal responsiveness and accountability to each other and the world of which we are. This is Erica. She is a palm tree. We do a palm celebration at Easter. We highlight some of the religious celebrations. Many of our children come from unchurched families, and so we want them to see the joy of Christian life and to have a true celebration. This is a Passover meal. We tell the Passover story. Here's the art teacher telling a part of the story. Two of our students at the meal. Of our teachers, a kindergarten teacher whom I quoted and her assistant. This is our newest program, it's the preschool program. So junior high students. Our eighth grade students, actually it's seventh and eighth grade, have to do exhibition pieces. So this was a they had to do a piece on service. This was a, so they designed an art piece to go with their talk. This was someone who spoke on Martin Luther King Jr. Some quilt work, the second grade does a study of books. Puppets, the second grade also does a study of notable Americans. More of our students. Our students went to the synagogue. Here they are carrying baby food to the pantry on the hike again. Out in the cornfields in Pennsylvania. What role might spiritual formation have in your teaching? What Well, your own spiritual formation is essential. You can take care of that and make sure you're in a place where you're being fed and actively growing in your faith is important. In our school, worship is something that happens daily. In many Christian schools, you have chapel once a week. We have what we call community worship every day. And our students come together as a community, and different teachers take turns in leading that. And that helps develop our community too, because children get to know other teachers' voices. Teachers get to know other children. So we found that to be very helpful. Prayer in many forms. We sing our prayers. We do sign language with our prayers. We draw our prayers, particularly during Lent. We show images. We go through the life of Christ, and we have children either draw or write off of those images as we read to them from Scripture. We follow this saying, and I think particularly when Tom was talking about forgiveness, our acts become our habits. Our habits become our character. And in teaching the disciplines of respect and care for each other, that's how we see these things being played out. We do teach children at a very young age to say, I'm sorry, and the response is, I forgive you. And I have to say, particularly with young children, that's very easy to do. It starts to become part of their vocabulary. We encourage them not to, they also can say, I accept your apology. But there's something about saying those words, I forgive you, which is very empowering. So we talk about forgiveness being a circle, that someone can say, I'm sorry, but you're granting that forgiveness releases that person. Yeah. And we found that with our children, they tend to, the ones who have been with us from kindergarten, they learn that very easily. Forgiveness is very easily granted, because sometimes all you need to do is give voice to the hurt. And I'm not talking about deep wounds here, but I'm talking about the little things that happen every day. And I find that children can be very forgiving in that way. There is, we will have times of confession and forgiveness. I've been in classes where everything just seems to be going wrong and everyone seems unsettled. And either myself or another teacher will say the question, yeah, something's happening here. Something isn't right. And I just feel like, you know, I've been irritated with you and I need to confess that I'm sorry that I've been that way with you. And I'm wondering if there are others who need to confess to you. And there are other children who will confess and say that they've done things that are hurtful. And somehow that really helps clear the air. And we agree to forgive each other communally. That will also happen individually with people. And we will have teachers who I have gone up to students that have gotten too angry with and had a harsh time with, and I've asked them to forgive me. And I think it's very empowering for students to see that model. That we all need forgiveness, and that's granted. There were two boys a couple weeks ago who I was very irritated with because they had, you know, not followed the rules, and some of our students have problems with English, and so one of the things I find is very helpful to do is I take out my laptop whenever someone gets sent to me because you can't solve this problem, and I listen with my laptop. I say, tell me your story. And so I just start taking, there's something about the computer that's very neutral, and there's something about the fact that I'm listening to them and I'm not the teacher that's angry with them. So I go, I just really want to understand what's going on. And so then I ask some questions to clarify, and somehow the story becomes clear. And there's something about telling the story of what happened that helps release that. And these two boys, their two stories didn't mesh. The teacher had done it with them in the classroom, and they had two totally different stories. So my task was to have them come together and tell me the same story. So, you know, and then we all have to learn how to take turns. So they took turns, and I'm just seeing the places where the errors were made. So I said to them, you know, there's at least six mistakes that were here, so let me read to you the story. And I know that they're not great listeners, so I decided I happen to have some blocks in my brain. So I started stacking up the blocks for every mistake. I said, here's mistake number one. And they knew it. When I would get to that point, I'd go, mistake number one, do you know what it is? We got to six mistakes. And when we got to six mistakes, I said, okay, you know, there were too many mistakes that happened here. We also talk about logical consequences. So I said, you know, this happened out on the playground where, you know, in this one area, and I just don't think you're ready to be with each other in that area because you're not following the rules of how to be in that area. So one person was responsible for four of the mistakes, the other for two. So I said, 4 days you won't be there, 2 days you won't be there. Is that understood? Yeah, it was understood. I said, okay, so are you ready to go back? Do you think you can go back to your classroom? So the one with two mistakes went sooner because I talked to the one with four mistakes a little longer because I had explained his four mistakes. And I went back into the classroom, and the one with the two mistakes was not ready to go back to work. I mean, he was obviously not working in the classroom, and the one with four mistakes went exactly in the opposite direction of where he needed to go, so I could tell he was not working. So I called him back in, and I said, look, I thought you guys said you were ready. You know, we talked about this. It's very clear what happened. But then I realized there was one thing I hadn't done, which we typically do. And I said, you know, is there something else that we need to do here? Do we need to ask for forgiveness? And right away, the one boy said, I'm sorry, and we asked them to explain specifically what the behavior is and look the person in the eye, because there's that accountability to the other person. Because otherwise, it's, I'm sorry I got in trouble, I'm sorry, you know, that you noticed, I'm sorry. So we have them say exactly what it is, and then the other one says, I forgive you. And so then the other child had apologized for his mistakes. And they'll be very clear, when this is part of their act, part of their habit, it doesn't take a lot for this to happen. And so they did that without much cajoling on my part, any cajoling on my part at all. And when that was done, I said, okay, now are you ready to go back to class and work? And they both looked at me and said, I said, no. And they went back in, and they went back to work. Their souls were renewed. So I just think the forgiveness thing is huge. You know, and we can have logical consequences, but to me, that's faith, that's spirituality coming into education in the ways that we live. So confession and forgiveness, I think, are important, and serving in a variety of ways. So, what is God calling you to, and how will you know? Well, I think you need to trust that God will lead you to the place of work. You need to search it out, but God will open the doors and close the doors. I would encourage you to talk with those who know you best, who know your gifts, who know your limitations. If you can have a clearness committee, I don't know if you're familiar with that at all, but it is a way where you have three or four people who will sit down with you for 2 hours and ask you authentic questions that they can't answer and only you can answer. That's very helpful in helping you to go deep into what your questioning is and what your searching is, and to help you find an answer to your question. I would ask for signs, for things, and to look for the things that are in place for you in your life to do. Do you have a praying community? For me, it was, will I have a place where I can worship if I move out there? I wanted to have a visit, so I went and I visited. I wanted to know that I had at least somebody out there who knew me, and I had college friends who were out there who actually said to me, come and live with us for a couple of months while you settle in. So that was a blessing for me, in that sort of a green light. I was in a season of life where I could easily move when I was there. And a little curious thing is, I said, you know, I'd really like to have a new guitar. And so I prayed about getting a new guitar, and I didn't have much time to look for one because it was in the summer where I was working, and so there was this music store on the road while I was praying for the guitar, and I stopped there, sure enough, went in there, they had a 12-string, which is what I wanted, and it was on sale. So I bought the guitar in faith and took the guitar with me. So I think sometimes there are those little things along the way that are encouragements to help you know what God has called you to do. And then there is this sense of, you know, you stay while you're growing and while you're learning, as long as you're learning and growing. And maybe it's 2 years, maybe it's three, maybe it's 30, you know, you don't know exactly what it is. The other thing I think is it depends on the community that you're with. And I'm just going to close with this one story. I felt a real need to start a preschool a number of years ago. And the Mustard Seed School did not feel this need to start a preschool. That community was not ready for it. But I had been approached by some others who wanted to have this preschool. And I could arrange my schedule so I could work part-time and start this preschool part-time. So I did, and I had 14 students, and we had a place we were invited to stay in and be in. It was a beautiful experience. I thought, this is great. It brought me great joy. And I thought, this is really what I would like to do. But when we got to the spring of this year, and then we talked about what would we do next with the program, we couldn't quite stay in the same space. We were in a church that was growing, and it was growing so big that we wouldn't be able to stay in that place. So to be in another space, it would require lots of financing and code work and all this sort of thing. And we didn't have expertise within our group, our working committee, to do that. And so we decided there wasn't the level of support that we needed to continue it. So we said we would end the preschool. Now, that could be failing, right? Where was this call? I thought I was called to do this. Things were in place. It didn't happen. Or it happened, but only for a year. And as someone said to me, even if it's just for that year in a child's life, that's significant. And you need to think about that. That's grace for a child for a year. So the following year, we had a hiatus, and we said, we're just not going to think about it for a year. And then these same mothers came back to me and said, now won't you consider trying again? And I just thought, oh. All right, let's ask the question. So I asked most of you guys, and said, would you be interested in seeing this? Now, they had seen this other one that I had done. And I think there was enough interest at that point in realization that we were to make it happen, and that it was a desire on my part. And they said, okay. So we started it 1 year, similar sort of thing, 14 students. By the next year, we tripled to 42 students. And now we're in a better place than what we were. So I would just say sometimes those things you dream about or you sense your call to, sometimes they're very short. You know, and sometimes it's just preparing you for the next thing. So that's